You didn't hear me. My name's Eddie. I'm alcoholic. I am sober tonight by the grace of a power I call God. It was a power I was listening to before I experienced the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I mean when I say that is, I don't keep me sober. It's not my job. I'm not very good at it. I tried that for a long time and I failed miserably. The belief that I could keep myself sober almost killed me. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and unfortunately, there were some people here who tried to reinforce that belief for me that I could keep myself sober, and in doing so, I almost died. But I'm not one of those people. And if you are, I'm glad you are, but I'm just not. You know, interestingly enough, I sometimes come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I hear somebody say, I just didn't know it was the alcohol. Ever heard that in AA meeting? I'm always amused by that, and here's why. Because at the ripe old age of 17, I figured out it was the alcohol. I drove my car at about 70 miles an hour to a parked car. It took them about an hour to get the two cars apart. The first person I saw was a Suffolk County police officer. He was in uniform. He dragged me out the window of the car, threw me on the ground, and then he kicked me. See, it was his car that I hit. He was not happy. And it occurred to me, this has got to stop. So I woke up the next morning and started on a series of journeys. I probably had that conversation with myself a couple thousand times, but the conversation went something like, I gotta stop. This has gotta stop. I'm gonna die from this. This is killing me. And I had figured out at 17 that if I didn't take the first drink, I wouldn't get drunk. Look, I figured that part out too. Bill writes in his story, it's on page 5, you'll look it up, he said right to the throat, I woke up, this had to be stopped. See, just like me, he had the same experience. And then he writes, I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I had that same experience that morning. I woke up, this has to be stopped, and I can't even take one drink. And then he writes, before then I had made lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Well, that morning I meant business, I really did. The next sentence in Bill's story is my sentence too. It says, shortly afterward I came home drunk. Wait a minute. He figured out that it was the first drink, and he knew he needed to stop. What happened? Well, he suffers from alcoholism, but I didn't understand what that meant. See, if knowing I shouldn't drink kept me from drinking, I'm wasting my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I'm one of those people that knowing I shouldn't drink doesn't keep me from drinking. But I didn't understand that at the time. I started to experience that over and over again for the course of the next 20 years. Knowing I shouldn't drink, what I did is I proceeded to drink for almost 20 years knowing I shouldn't drink. And I stopped countless times. And then 20 years later, I'm driving home from Albany, New York. And it was one of those thousands of days that I wasn't going to drink today. And I pull in the driveway at home here in Long Island, and I look in the rearview mirror, and it occurs to me that I don't remember how I got home from Albany, New York. That's a pretty long drive. And the thought comes to me, I could have killed these kids. And the next thought I have is, this has got to stop. The problem is, by the time I said that then, I had already said that like 5,000 times. That's why I say I'm amused when I hear someone come to AA and they say, once I figured out it was the alcohol, I just stopped. I think, really? Because that may be true for them. But I don't know that they're like me. Because I figured that out 20 years earlier and it didn't stop. So that night I said, this has got to stop. I could have killed these kids. And the next morning I woke up and I was done. I'm not drinking anymore. And the morning after that I got a call from my identical twin brother. I have an identical twin brother. When I say we're identical, we share common DNA. If he leaves his blood somewhere at a crime scene, they come check me. I'm in trouble. Because our DNA is identical. Interestingly enough, he's a multi-million dollar a year corporate attorney. And also, he's alcoholic. They're starting to find out that alcoholism seems to have a genetic component. And when you have identical twins, the correlation's about 85%, even if they were raised in different places. That's pretty scary. But because he was a multi-million dollar a year corporate attorney, he had gotten sober already. But he was drinking, before that, I was drinking about a quart of Georgie out of the plastic squeeze bottle, you know, the good stuff. He was drinking Johnny Walker Blue. He goes, ooh, I didn't even know what blue was. I have to tell you, I knew Johnny Walker Red. I really didn't like it. Johnny Walker Black, like if I was in a bar and you were buying, I'd let you buy me a black. I thought that was kind of funny. Johnny Walker Blue is $300 a bottle. But when you're a multi-million dollar a year corporate attorney and you've got a reputation to uphold, you drink Johnny Walker Blue. But he was alcoholic just like me. But he had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he called me And we had one of those phone calls. I'm sure if you're in the room here tonight, you've probably had one of these phone calls from a family member. It goes something like this. You know, you need to do something about your drinking.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I said, I have. He said, what's that? I said, I'm not drinking anymore. And he asked me a question, which when I think about today, is a little puzzling, and it may puzzle some of you. This is what he said to me. I just told him I wasn't drinking. He said, how's that working out for you? That should be good, right?
That's not my experience.
And he understood because it wasn't his experience either. When he said, how's that working out for you? He knew it was not working out for me. Sometimes I hear people say that. Once I stopped drinking, everything was wonderful. That's not my experience. If that's yours, that's wonderful. But it's not mine. So when he said, how's that working out for you? I said, it's not. And he said something about Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, no thanks. And about a week and a half later, he called back and he said, how's that not drinking thing going? I said, it's getting worse. Does anybody know what I mean when I say it's getting worse? I haven't had a drink in a week and a half, and it's getting worse. It's not out there in the world, by the way. It's in here in my head. And it's getting pretty bad. And the longer I'm sober, the worse it gets. And he said something else about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, Alcoholics Anonymous? Those pathetic losers? I had heard of you people. They make fun of you on TV. Anyone ever seen the Seinfeld episode, the guy going around making his amends? We became like a joke at cocktail parties and on TV. And I wasn't having anything to do with that. I said, what are they going to do for me there? He said, something about a big book and something about the 12 steps. And I guess I wasn't paying any attention, but I hung up the phone and I did what any sensible drunk would do on a Sunday night at about 8:30. I got in the car and I drove over to Borders in search of a big book. It's really kind of a fun experience, and if you've never tried it, I recommend you do. Walk into Borders, walk up to the little woman at the information desk, and say, I'd like a big book. Yeah. Well, I was wrecked. I mean, you know, I wasn't thinking straight. You know what she said to me? How big a book would you like? She said, because the really big books are over there. And she pointed to the corner, and that's where they have the really big ones that won't fit on a shelf. You know, they're too big. And I wandered around the store, and in the self-help section, they had this version of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. The plain, it was a bigger one, but it's plain blue. It didn't say anything. That blue and yellow screaming cover that we have, the hard, I'm not sure I would have walked through the store with that one. Because I don't need everybody to know I'm alcoholic, but this looks pretty harmless. I figured I could get this past the clerk. And I tell you, it was in the self-help section because I find that kind of amusing today, that the book was in the self-help section. Because it occurs to me today that whoever put the book in the self-help section either didn't read it or didn't understand it. Because the entire premise of this book is that you can't help yourself. Nowhere in this book does it suggest you can help yourself. This is not a self-help program. But I didn't understand that. It was in the self-help section. But I get up to her to register to ring it up, and she does one of these little things, and it goes, beep, boop, and it comes up and says, error. Oh, yeah. Because you know what I'm expecting now. They grab the little microphone, right? And they go, we had a price check on Alcoholics Anonymous. God knows I don't want any part of that. But she puts in the little numbers in the back, and they charge you something like $16.95 because they screw you over at Borders. And I get in the car and I start to read. And let me tell you, God, is this book awful. How many of you have tried to read this book? It's awfully written. I mean, it reads like it was written in the 1930s. By a Protestant from Vermont. It was. And the language is really, it's archaic, it's old-fashioned, it doesn't really, we don't talk the way this book's written anymore. I didn't understand how bad it was until I started sponsoring young kids, this 19-year-old kid, and one night I'm sitting in the car with this 19-year-old kid, and I'm taking him through this book one line at a time, and every time I read a line, he says, what does that mean? And I explain it to him, and I read the next line. He goes, what does that mean? And I explain it to him, and I read the next line. After about an hour of this, he looks over at me, and he goes, yo, dog, I'm mad tired. I gotta go to my crib and crash. And it occurred to me at that moment, we weren't speaking the same language. And there was no way he was going to understand what this book was talking about from the 1930s. Chock full of great information, but anyway, I got in the car and I tried to read this book, and God, it was awful, but I couldn't sleep. See, one of the things that happens to me, when I stop drinking, I don't sleep. Anybody relate? Like, it's not like everything gets wonderful and everything turns rosy. It doesn't. I stop drinking and I come unglued, and I can't sleep, so I read all night long. And I call my brother back at 6:30 the next morning. He's in Dallas. I call him. I said, well, I got this big book. He said, well, how was the meeting? I said, I didn't go to a meeting. I went to Borders. And he laughed, just like that. And I said, why is that funny? And so he said,
Well, what'd you think? And I said, well, it reminds me of the self-help program I did 10 years earlier. I did one of those Tony Robbins-type powerful living self-help programs. It was a great program. It just didn't get me sober. I said, this reminds me of that. He said, you might want to read that book again. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. By the way, it's 5:30 a.m. in Dallas. Don't call me this early. And he hung up. So 2 weeks go by, and I'm really coming unglued. Another week goes by, I'm coming off the charts. I'm not drinking, but this isn't working. And I don't know what I got to do. Because I've read this book now 2 or 3 times, and it makes no sense to me. And I really just have one question. What do I have to do? Who's going to tell me what I have to do? So I walk into an AA meeting, and I think, first, I'm terrified to go in. I don't know anybody in this meeting. I'm hoping I don't know anybody. You know that first meeting. You walk in, and you think, oh, God, I hope I don't see anybody I know. It's okay. They're there for the same reason, but you don't think that way. And I get to this meeting, and I walk in, and I'm terrified. I look around the room, and I think, I hope someone's going to tell me how to do this, because I'm not drinking, and I can't take it anymore. And a guy comes to the front of the room, and he tells this horrific drunkalog. He had been shot, beaten, stabbed, left for dead, covered in blood. He had beaten up small children and robbed some little old ladies. He had done every horrendous thing under the sun. And I'm sitting listening to him going, oh, God. What do I have to do? And I still have that one question. What do I have to do? And I'm waiting for him to tell me what I have to do. Tell me. He continues to tell his drunk log for what seems like forever. And then at the very end, he says, and then I stopped drinking and everything got wonderful and they all stopped. And I'm sitting there and my thought is, how? How did you do that? He didn't tell me how. And then I started to think, who's going to tell me how? And I look around and I'm kind of scared. They start raising their hands and I thought, oh my God, these people are going to tell me how. Oh yeah. The first woman, she told me how. She told me how she had parked her car in a handicap spot at the Smith Haven Mall, and she didn't have a handicap permit, and how they gave her a parking ticket. You know what she's talking about for the next 10 minutes? Her parking ticket. And I thought, oh God, who's going to tell me how? And the next guy raised his hand. He was in a suit and tie, and I thought, this guy looks respectable. He's going to tell me how. He told me how. He told me how I haven't had a drink in 10 years, but I've been going through this awful divorce. You know what he talked about for 10 minutes? His awful divorce. So one after another, they went around the room kind of complaining about their life. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, who's going to tell me how? And one after another, they just keep complaining about their life. And then I start to think, I am never, ever, ever coming back here to listen to you all complain about your life. Any of you have ever had that thought in an AA meeting? Come on, be honest. Yeah? They know you're thinking it. I didn't know a single person in the room. I hadn't said a word. And they knew that I was thinking I was never coming back. You know how I know they knew I was thinking this? Because without saying a word, this little old lady leaned over to me and she said the most ridiculous thing I ever heard in my whole life. She said, he's coming back. And I thought, why would you say that to somebody who hasn't opened their mouth? Unless you know I'm not coming back. And I was not going back. So I went home and I called my brother and I said, well, you know, all these people do is complain about their life. He said, that doesn't sound like any AA meeting I've ever been to. You might want to try another meeting. I said, well, maybe you want to come to New York. He said, just try another meeting. And I started going on to meetings, and that's all they were doing. So I decided they actually encouraged me to do the same thing. You ever been to one of those meetings? And they encourage you. Share. About what? Your problems. Share about my problems? Yeah. I'd love to do that. I couldn't wait to raise my hand and talk about my favorite subjects. You know what my favorite subject is? Me. Every problem, issue, and complaint I have. And I do that under the belief that if you all can help me fix all that mess out there in the world, then I'll feel okay and I won't drink. Sounds like a good plan, right? Any of you think it might be not true? Let's find out. How many of you drank when you had an awful lot of money? Raise your hand. No money? Great job. No job. Nice place to live. Old car, rusted out. You're living there. How about when you were dating somebody you really loved? Someone awful? Did it matter? You know, in our big book, they write this line. It took me a while to understand what they were trying to tell me. The line says, it was the end of a perfect day. Not a cloud on the horizon. Anybody want to guess what that guy's doing the next day? He's drinking. Wait, it's a perfect day. How could that be? It's not related that way, but I don't understand that. They encouraged me to do that, so I start raising my hand, sharing about my favorite subject, me. And then they give me a bunch of other great suggestions. They tell me to mop the floors and stack the chairs and make the coffee. So I start to do that. Then they tell me, meeting makers make it. So I decide if meeting makers make it, I should go to more than one meeting a day. I start going to 2 meetings a day. I go to the 6 a.m. meeting and the 7:30 meeting. And then I go to the 6 6 a.m. meeting, the 12 o'clock meeting, the lunchtime meeting, and the 7:30 meeting. Then I find out there's a 5:30 happy hour meeting. You don't want to miss that one. So I go to the 6 a.m. meeting, the noon meeting, the 5:30 happy hour meeting, the 7:30 meeting, and then I find out there's a midnight meeting over at the Pit in Bayshore. Which, by the way, is an experience you must have. And I start going to that meeting too. And at every meeting, I raise my hand, I can't wait to get it up, and talk about me. Every problem, issue, and complaint that I have. And I do this under the belief that I'm going to get better.
But I'm not. Getting sicker. I don't understand it. And I really want to know, what do I have to do? Because they keep telling me things to do, and I keep doing them. I'm mopping floors, stacking chairs, I'm calling all these drunks every night. And every one of them I call, I do the same thing. I kind of complain about my life for a while. And then when they complain about theirs, I don't really listen, but I yes them to death.
Uh-huh.
Really?
Uh-huh.
God, that sounds awful.
She did what?
Oh, God.
All right, I got to run. Next up, yes. And then I call someone else. And then I have this guy who's my sponsor, and I call him every night, and I complain about my life. Blah, 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 blah. And after he can finally get a word in edgewise, he says, did you drink today? And I say, no. He says, good. Call me tomorrow. I wish it were funny. I wish it were funny. Because 4 months into that plan, I am now dying from alcoholism. I'm not drinking, and I'm dying from alcoholism. I'm beginning to think to myself, if I can find the fuse that controls the airbag on my car, I'm going to disconnect it. Then I'm going to drive my car into a tree at about 100 miles an hour. Anybody relate? I'm not drinking, but I can't take the pain of being sober one more day. I walk out of this meeting and the guy says, you look awful. I said, I'm thinking about killing myself. He says, you know what you need to do? I said, oh, please tell me. Please, what do I need to do?
Oh, here it comes. He said, you just need to go to more meetings.
I said, buddy, I go to 4, sometimes 5 meetings a day.
But I really don't know what to tell you. Thank you. Thanks for sharing all that hope.
I went home that night, and I went online. And online, I went to these meetings. Have you ever been to an online meeting? It's great, especially if you're complaining about your life. You can only type so fast. You can't complain a whole lot. You've got to be very concise about how you complain. But that night, unless you type really fast, I always felt bad for the old-timers who didn't type, and you can tell it one letter at a time, and you see it coming up, click, 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 and go, oh, God. But this one night, I go home, and I type in. I mean, I'm ready. I'm done. I reached for a book called The Jumping Off Place. I now wish for the end. If you read that sometime, it's in a chapter called A Vision About You. It says, now and then a serious great drinker being dry at the moment says, and this is something you'll hear from people, I don't miss it at all. Feel better. Work better. I need a better time. I hear that all the time. But if you read on, this is what it says. It says, as ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. I'm going to translate that because this book was written a long time ago. We smile at such a sally? What the hell does that mean? Well, it means we think the guy's full of crap. But imagine I wanted to tell you were full of crap and I walked up to you and I said, I smile at such a sally. Fools himself. This guy who doesn't miss it at all feels better, works better, having a better time. He fools himself. Inwardly, the book says he'd give anything to take a half dozen drinks to get away with him. He'll presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. Well, nobody warned me about that. They said things to me like, if you didn't drink today, you never had it so good. That book doesn't say that. And it goes on to say that eventually this guy can't imagine his life with alcohol or without it. And then he knows the loneliness that very few do. Then he's at the jumping off place. And he's wishing for the end. For the end of what? He's not drinking. Well, I found out after 4 months in AA. I was wishing for the end of my life. I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I don't know what to do about it. And I'm doing everything they ask me to do. Anybody relate?
No.
Yeah, I'm going to be going, yeah. Book's got 3 people who died that I recall. One's in Bill's story, hung himself, suicide. Another one put a shotgun in his mouth and blew his head off, suicide. Another one jumped out the window, suicide.
What are they trying to tell us?
Off themselves, suffering from alcoholism. I don't know. I think they might have been trying to tell me that that's what untreated alcoholism looks like. But I didn't get that. Because I'm not drinking, so I can't be suffering from alcoholism, can I?
Oh, yeah.
But I don't understand what it means to be alcoholic. And that night, I type into this little IM window, and this guy's name pops up. He says, my name's Marvin. Call me. And he put his number in. And I called him. He said, my name's Marvin. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I said, you're a what? He said, I'm a recovered alcoholic.
I said, well, now, let me tell you, buddy. I've been to a lot of AA meetings. There's no such thing as a recovered alcoholic. Who told you that? He said, you own a big book? I said, oh, God, please, don't tell me about that awful book. I don't understand anything that's in that book. He said, do you own one? I said, yes. He said, go get it. I'm going to help you. He took me to the title page of the book. He asked me to read him what it said on the title page. Well, it said Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And then he asked me this kind of rhetorical question. He said, do you think they may have recovered when they wrote it on the title page? I said, I don't know. I had never heard that. I had heard things like, I'll meet your recovering. And I just wanted to know who wanted to join that group. And he said, recovered? I said, no way. He said, read the first sentence they wrote. He took me to the forward of the first edition. It contained the very first sentence they wrote in the book. He said, read me what it says. Since we've Alcoholics Anonymous, one in 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then he asked me again, do you think they meant recovered when they wrote it on the title page and when they wrote it as the first sentence of the book? I said, well, I don't know. He said, why don't you read the next sentence of the book? He said, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. He said, do you think they meant recovered when they wrote it on the title page, when they wrote it as the first sentence, when they wrote it as the second sentence? I said, you all start to think maybe they did. He said, well, they wrote it like 15 more times. Nowhere in that book does it suggest you'll always be recovering. So the next person who tells you that, ask them where it comes from, because it's not come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, you know, our fellowship is named after a book. Did you know that? I said, no, I didn't. What book? Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, our fellowship is named after a book? He said, yes. I said, how do you know that? He said, it's in the book. Did you read the book? I said, no. He said, in the bottom of the second edition, it says we were nameless and we took our name from the book. I said, really? He said, it's the only place you'll find the written program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, let's go over that again. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. He said, tell me precisely what you're doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I misunderstood that question really bad. I said, what am I doing? I'm a drunk. He said, no. Not why are you here. What do you do? I said, oh, that's easy. Let me tell you, I was a smartass. I said, what do? I go to 4 or 5 meetings a day. I raise my hand. I complain about my life. I don't really listen when other people are complaining about theirs. I'm off the floor. I stack the chairs. I make the coffee. I call 5 or 6 other drunks and I complain about my life. If they start complaining about theirs, I hang up. I call this guy as my sponsor. I complain about my life. He says, did you drink? I say, no. He says, good. Call me tomorrow. He says, that's what you're doing. Smartass that I was, I said, precisely. Excuse me? He said, who told you that would get you sober? I said, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I don't think you're hearing it very well. He said, but the next person who tells that, ask them where they got that from. He said, I'd like you to do me a favor. You sound like a smart enough guy. You tell me you don't understand this book, but I'd like you to do me a favor. I'd like you to read it one more time tonight. And I'd like you to find it for me precisely or any other way where it says to do any of the things that you described that you're doing. You will not find any of them in the program of alcohol. Well, you better not come to one of the AEDs. I go to and say that. Man, that'll put you up on the cross in front of the room. Nail you right in. Then I'll just hand him the big book and say, show me where it says to do anything. I'm not playing. So I suppose if you do that stuff, you will always be recovering and relapsing and recovering and relapsing and recovering and relapsing. Or you can do what I've done. You can do what these people have done. You can recover, too. Thousands of us have. You can, too. You know what that man gave me for that instant for the first time ever in Alcoholics Anonymous? Gave me hope that I was going to be sick and suffering and struggling and hanging on one day at a time. So I didn't have one day left. I was ready to kill myself. He gave me hope. And then he started to take me through this book and show me what it meant to be alcoholic. And that was where we started. Did you call yourself an alcoholic? What does that mean? I said, it means I drink too much. He said, a lot of people drink too much. They are not alcoholic. So what does that mean? He started to explain to me. First thing he asked me about was knowledge. He wanted me to understand that knowing I shouldn't drink didn't keep a guy like me from drinking. And he asked me to look at my truth. He said, did you know at some point in your life you needed to stop? I said, absolutely. Did that knowledge keep you from drinking again? I said, absolutely not. I said, okay. What else you got? Let's take them. Willpower. How's that worked out for you? I said, are you going to forget willpower? That doesn't work at all. I said, okay. He said, how about the memory of those awful things that have happened to you? I said, that doesn't last very long. I have some awful experiences. 2 or 3 days later, I can't remember that experience with enough force to keep you from drinking again. I may remember it, but my mind keeps saying, it wasn't so bad, or it'll be okay, or this time it'll be different.
He said, all right, so if knowledge won't stop you, and memory won't stop you, and willpower won't stop you, what else do you got?
I don't know. I started to feel a little screwed. As a matter of fact, I told him when I saw the truth about that. Dumbass.
So we actually like the word powerless better. It looks a whole lot better than that. Pointless and academic for a guy like me. This is what the book says. Because I was powerless over whether I was going to put in that first drink or not.
I struggled with that. I kept looking backwards on my life, the truth. Kept asking me, what's your truth? My truth is this. Knowing I shouldn't drink doesn't keep me from drinking. Consequences don't keep me from drinking. Willpower doesn't keep me from drinking. Those are the three elements that make up power to choose anything.
I only choose whether to go to work or not.
It's going to come from knowledge, memory, and willpower.
If I want to choose not to touch that hot stove, it's not going to come from pain, that choice, because if I feel pain, I've already touched it. It's going to come from knowledge, memory, or willpower. And he said the book describes that we suffer from a complete failure of the same defense that keeps me from putting my hand on a hot stove. And as I look backwards on my life, see, I wanted to look forwards and say, well, now that I know... Anybody ever heard that in an AA meeting? Now that I know, how many times in my life had I said, now that I know, I'm never drinking again? Thousands. He said, it doesn't sound like a guy like you carry that out. Look at the truth. Man, I have to tell you, that truth hit me right here. But the other thing he showed me was that this unmanageable part that we talk about in our first step. Dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. If you had asked me 4 months into my experience of AA what unmanageable was, I would say I get drunk and do stupid things. And all those stupid things are the unmanageable portion of my life. Marvin said that's not at all what they're talking about in our big book. So what do you mean? He said, no, they're saying with or without alcohol, your life's unmanageable. Unmanageable, he asked me things like, was I having trouble with personal relationships? Was I afraid of misery and depression? Did I have feelings of uselessness? Was I unable to control my emotional nature? Well, none of that's how I felt when I was drunk. That's how I feel sober. And when you take my booze away, and when I can't stand to feel like that anymore, do you know what I do? Drinking turns out is my solution. I vote my problems. Martin said, if I thought alcohol was my problem, I'd probably die drunk. I said, that's ridiculous. He said, okay, if alcohol's your problem, tell me what happens to you when you stop drinking. I said, well, I get angry, pissed off, can't sit still, I get depressed, I get homicidal, I get suicidal. I can't sleep. He said, eventually, what do you do? I said, I drink. That makes it go away like that. He said, it sounds like drinking's your solution. He said, when you stop drinking, does your problem go away? I said, no, it gets worse. We have a name for people like you. What's that? Alcoholic. Tell me if my problem's alcohol, I was wasting my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, that was insane. But he said, if my problem was alcohol, my solution would be simple. Somebody tell me, what would my solution be if my problem was alcohol? Just don't drink. And he said, okay, so when you just don't drink, what happens to you? I said, I get suicidal. I can't, I come unglued. My head explodes. It gets really messy and painful. He said, eventually, what do? I said, I drink because I can't take it anymore. Then eventually you start to think that alcohol's your problem, and then you stop because alcohol's your problem. Your solution is not to drink. But it sounds to me like you have an awful sobriety problem. I said, I do. He said, it sounds to me like you've been treating your awful sobriety problem with booze for a long time. I said, I have. I don't know what else to treat it with. I said, exactly. He said, if you treat it with cheeseburgers, we send you to Overeaters Anonymous. If you treat it by gambling, we send you to Gamblers Anonymous. If you treat it with drugs, we send you to Narcotics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous. If you treat it with alcohol, we send you to Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of different solutions. Those people all have the same problem, don't they? And you take it away, I'm unglued. Because if my life truly got wonderful when I stopped drinking, I never would have gotten good. Ever. You know, you all seem like nice people, but it's like Saturday night, you know? Like, I'm sure there's some place I could be other than here. So after I said to him, I'm screwed, because I realized the truth, I could see the truth, my life was unmanageable whether I drank or not. As a matter of fact, the unmanageability is why I drank. It was unmanageable in here, not out there. And I drank because it made it better in here. It didn't make it worse out there in the world, right? But in here, when I drank, it got better. Anybody relate?
They ought to have that hanging up in the front of some of these meetings. When you drink, your head will feel better. It's true. We went lying and say, no, it'll feel worse.
Really? What alcoholic will tell you that? Someone wants to lie to you. You know it's not even true. No, it feels better instantly. And then it causes all these other problems out there in the world, and up here feels better instantly. But I can see the truth, and I can see that nothing I knew, nothing I would remember, no amount of fear, no amount of consequences, and no good reason would ever keep me from taking the first drink again the next time. So I had lots of good reasons. They wouldn't stop me. And I was screwed. Finally, I said to him, what am I going to do? So what are you going to do? What I asked him. He said, I can't do anything. So what am I going to do? We started to have a conversation about God, and I said, oh, no, 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 you're not one of them. You're one of them? You're one of those God people? Oh, no. I had heard you people. I had avoided you people. I had stayed away from you people. I mean, God is a nice story to tell little children, but come on. Please. I outgrew that a long time ago. And that's what I said to him. I said, it's like Santa Claus. He said, Santa Claus is a good analogy. We can use Santa Claus. I said, oh, good. We're going to talk about Santa Claus. He said, well, maybe it'll help you. He said, tell me what Santa Claus looks like. So I described the person as Santa Claus. Red outfit, black boots, white beard, green sack, full of toys, reindeer, red one nose, red nose in the front. I had it down good. He said, good. You go to the North Pole, will you find Santa Claus? I laughed. I said, no. See, I was right. There was no Santa Claus. He said, good. So you understand that there's no being called Santa Claus. I said, exactly. He said, let me ask you a question. Is there a power called Santa Claus? First, I said, no. He said, you don't think there's a power called Santa Claus. You must come with me to Toys R Us next November. Because you will see evidence of a power called Santa Claus. It has nothing to do with a fat guy in a red suit, does it? I said, no. He said, what does it have to do with? He said, what is this power that causes people to work overtime shifts, to save their money, to buy presents, to give it to children in an anonymous name? What is that power? I said, I don't know, but it's a pretty powerful force. He said, yeah, it changes our whole economy. Black Friday. I said, it's a pretty powerful force, isn't it? I said, oh, yeah. He said, they don't even take any credit for it. People who give these figures, that's pretty powerful, isn't it? He said, but are you looking for a person called Santa Claus or a power called Santa Claus? And so we're talking about a power. He said, where would you find that power? Certainly not at the North Pole. I said, no, you'd find that power here, inside of you. At work, at the human heart. That's right, it's a pretty powerful force. So you probably experienced that. I said, Santa Claus? He said, well, wait, love. He said, have you ever experienced the power called love? He said, there's no being called love, is there? I said, no. He said, is there a power called love? I said, well, actually there is, I guess. He said, when love is present in your life, does anybody need to tell you how to behave? No. He said, when love is present in your life, are you selfish or selfless? Well, selfless. Not lust. Lust, I'm really selfish. Love, I'm selfish. Selfless. Lust, I'm selfish. He said, okay, when love is present in your life, does anybody need to tell you what to do? I said, no. He said, are you honest or dishonest when love is present? I said, I'm honest. He said, are you afraid or not afraid? I said, I'm not afraid. He said, when love is present, do you even need to think about what to do? I said, no. Kind of intuitive. He said, when love is present, might you sacrifice your life for someone you love? Yeah, without thinking about it. So that's a pretty powerful force. I said, yes, it is. Pretty powerful force. Where would you find that force? I said, inside me. I said, good. Now you start to understand the distinction between a being and a power. He said, we're looking for a power, not a being. I paused and I said, wait a minute, are you saying God is love? Because that's brilliant. He said, oh, they wrote that in the Bible 2,000 years ago. I just don't think you understand it. So you're looking for a person called God. I'm talking about a power. Our book suggests, in that little spiritual appendix in the back, that most of us believe we've tapped an unsuspected inner resource. Let's take that slowly. Unsuspected, didn't know it was there. Inner resource, which we presently identify with a power greater than ourselves. Wait a minute, most of these people found God in here? Yeah, but I was looking out there. No. No wonder I couldn't find God. No wonder I thought that made no sense. Yes, it's a good story to tell children. But it doesn't make any sense. Not to me. It made perfect sense. For the first time ever, I understood what he was talking about. And I was willing to make a decision to turn my life over to this power that I began to call God, but it was not the God I walked in here thinking about. It was a power I came to know as love. Pretty powerful force. And then we had a conversation about what happens in my life
when love is present, I'm willing to do just about anything, right? You got that woman, love is present. You'll sacrifice your life for her, won't you? And then she gets a little bit under your skin. A couple of resentments, a little fear, a little dishonesty. And that same woman, the woman who you would have jumped in front of a movie train for, says to you, can you stop on the way home and pick me up some Ben and Jerry's? And you go, I have no story to stop home. It's all that a long day at work. True? He said, what happens to the power of love? Look, it's blocked off. He said, by what? Resentment. Dishonesty. Selfishness. Fear. Yeah, you'll be writing that in your fourth step. You'll understand what's blocking you from experiencing God. See, nothing in these steps, nothing, is designed to teach me about God. He said, he had nothing to teach me about God. He said, how can I teach you about something that's already part of you? He said, the best I can do is show you what it is that's blocking you from experiencing that which is inside of you. He said, if you can't keep yourself sober, and I figured out I couldn't, you're going to have to find a power that could. And this power I would find within myself as I looked at what it was that was blocking and tried to figure out what to do about that. Because once I wasn't blocked, like with the resentment, I would go back to being the power of love would take over, and I was that same woman who I wouldn't pick up the Ben and Jerry's for. I thought I might jump in front of the train for again once I got past that resentment. Everybody get how that works? God, that sounded so easy. I was sitting in AA meetings. Then we started talking. I went and shared that. Then we started talking about steps 6 and 7. I walked around. I was patting myself on the back. I was working on myself. I pulled something right over here every time I did it. Some of you have probably pulled something. I don't blame you. Well, you get the impression in AA that this step says, I'm not going to look at it. It says, and then we began to work on ourselves, and then we removed our own shortcomings. That's what I thought it meant. So I come to AA meetings, and I tell you I'm working. I told him, well, I'm working on myself. He said, you're doing what? I said, I'm working on myself. He said, where did you get the idea you were supposed to do that? I said, isn't that step 6 and 7? He said, you might want to read it again. By the way, the interesting part is, if you look at our big book, they spend like 50 pages explaining what it looks like to be powerless and what unmanageable is. Then they spend all these pages on God and how to understand that the idea of God that I have is so screwed up that I've made the word God mean something that it doesn't mean and trying to break me of those prejudices. And they beg me to lay aside those prejudices, even against organized religion. They beg me. They don't beg me not to drink, but they beg me to lay aside those. Then they show me how to make this decision, and they spend all these pages on how to do this inventory and how to share it with somebody. Then you get to step 6 and 7, and it's like 2 sentences. Why don't they have more information? He said, let's go back to love. He said, when love is present, are you doing anything? Watch. We're entirely ready to have love removed by defects of character. And he said to me, when love is present, do you exhibit defects of character? I said, no. He said, sounds like love removes them. Humbly had love remove your shortcomings. He says, when love is present, do you have shortcomings? I said, no. He said, it sounds like love removes them. He said, is that you doing anything? I said, no. He said, just being willing to have love remove them. Wow. No wonder there's no instruction in our big book about that. How do you explain to somebody how let it happen itself? By being present to love. By present to God. Couldn't. I'd much rather walk around and tell you I'm working on myself. But for the first time ever, step 6 and 7 made perfect sense because I could see from my own experience in my own life what that looked like. With this God I had come to understand. Step 8, I was to go out into the world and make those amends. And when the power of love was present, I had no problem making those amends. It wasn't on my power that I was making them. It was on power called love. And then I get to step 10. And it turns out that that power called love gets blocked real easy again. And then I'm supposed to continue to watch. That's the spiritual word they use. Watch. What is to watch? My favorite thing is watch what you're doing. Because I don't like it. It doesn't want me to do that. It wants me to watch what I'm doing. Watch myself. That's the spiritual term. Watch. And I'm supposed to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Why those things? Because those are the very things that are going to block me from that power that's taken away the defects of character that's given me this life of peace. And when they crop up, I'm supposed to ask God at once to remove them. So I call Marvin and I want to talk about it. Bring Marvin, my friend. Hello. I say, look, I got a problem. Did you ask God to remove it? I say, no. Well, call me back when you have, and you hang up. After I did that for a while, I call him, I'd want to share about these problems. He'd say, well, what did you do to set those in motion? I said, what do you mean? He goes, where were you the one who started? I said, me? He said, yeah, I don't care about what they did to you. I want to know what you did to them.
where this resentment came from inside of you. Because it's blocking you from experiencing the power that's keeping you sober.
And I can start to see the truth. Then at morning and at night, I was supposed to go through like these little checklists. I was supposed to ask myself some simple questions like, where have I been selfish today? Was I kind and loving towards all? Not normally when I'm driving. But I would honestly ask myself those questions every night. And no, I didn't always say yes. Yes, I always, when I realized the answer is no, ask God to show me a better way. Love, show me how.
In my prayer life, I was confused. I used to think God was my errand boy. My prayer life would look like this. God, you have to fix that person. The one I'm pissed off at. I'm supposed to pray for them. I said that to Marvin when he said, you're supposed to, what? I said, pray for them. He said, where did you get to that? I said, in AA. He said, you might want to read that again. It doesn't tell me to pray for them. That would look like this. Me saying to God, God, let me give you some advice here. You need to fix that guy over there because he's pissing me off. He said, that sounds like your ego run amok. I said, well, what am I supposed to do if I'm not supposed to pray for them? He said, read it again. You're supposed to ask God to show you. But wait a minute. I'm supposed to ask God to show me, yes, what I can do to be helpful to that person. God's not there to fix your problem. God's there so he can tell you. Go read it. That's the way I explained it. He said, you're supposed to ask God to show you, not them, you, how you can be helpful to them. Oh my God, that was a pretty different experience with step 11. So now all of a sudden this inventory that had to do makes sense. Like in the morning and at night before I pray. Because I'm supposed to ask myself so I can ask God what to do. Not what, not like God, you do this, but God, what do I do? And my prayer life became God, use me. God, use me. And in step 12, I was supposed to carry this message. So I'm back up, meet this guy, takes me through this book lovingly, one line at a time. Explains to me what it means, challenges me with things like, well, are you doing that yet? I'd say, no. Call me back when you are. 6 weeks after I met him, I was doing what the people who wrote this book did. 6 weeks later, I was out at a gas station on Saturday morning, paying back the guy some $300 I owed him that I had to forgot for a few years. You ever forget for a few years to pay somebody back some money? I did. You know, I do. And I came home on that Saturday morning, and I sat down on my couch in the middle of my ninth step, and it occurred to me, 6 weeks after meeting this man, that for the first time ever in my life, I did not want to drink. For the first time ever in my life, that screaming that was my brain was silenced, and it was replaced by a peace that was beyond all understanding. That for the first time in my life, it was okay for me to be me sober. I remember calling him up and saying, hey, something's happened to me. He said, what's that? I said, I don't know. It's like somebody turned my brain off. He said, well, you sound a little alarmed. I said, I guess I am. He said, quick, turn to page 14. And he read me a Bill story. This is what the line says. For I was alarmed. Like, oh, my friend the doctor asked me. He listened in wonder as I talked. And then he asked me this question. I want you to all think about this. What was Bill Wilson alarmed about? Mopping floors and stacking chairs and making coffee? Uh-huh. Did maybe the same thing happen to you that happened to Bill Wilson? He said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, that Monday morning, I went back to the 6 a.m. meeting, and I raised my hand at one point, and I shared for about 2 minutes, maybe 2.5. I can't tell you what I said, but I did talk about the peace I was experiencing, how I saw things differently. And I put my hand down, and I didn't make it to the door, and two men walked up to me and said, would you slot to me? God, I can't slot you. I'm not sober here. Some of you are laughing. So I went home, and I called Marvin. I said, Marvin, this guy wants me to sponsor him. Can you imagine? He said, well, good. I said, but I'm a sober year. He said, did you not understand our big book? He said, 6 months, Bill Wilson's sitting in a bar, he's about to get drunk. If he doesn't go help Dr. Bob, if he doesn't sponsor Dr. Bob, what's he going to do? I said, get drunk. He said, so he can't stay sober more than 6 months without doing it, and you think you'll be able to stay sober a year? Probably not. So what do I do? Tell him the truth. Do with him what I did with you. But you know, I came to find out that the truth wasn't always so popular in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I started to talk about what this book was talking about, people started to brand me with degrading names like, oh, you're one of those big book thumpers. No, no. Oh, I just want to talk about God. No, I actually don't. I'm not a little funny for God. Oh, you just want to. No, I don't. So, I was afraid. I didn't tell that man the truth. I started telling him some other things. I told him, just don't drink. Did you make your thinking? Keep coming back. I told him, if you have problems, call me up. We'll talk about them. Like I was his therapist. Anybody in here a trained therapist? Can you imagine that? You go to any meeting, there's almost no trained therapist in the room. But I was going to be his therapist, so we knew nothing about therapy. I was going to tell him how he should run his life. I was going to tell him how to think through the drink. I remember his classroom. All the things that didn't work for me, I was going to tell this man. And I did. Sounds pretty good, right? Well, 2 days before my first anniversary, his wife walks into the morning meeting. Says her eyes are just red, and she's puffy, and looks like she's been crying all night. I said, what's wrong? She said, my husband's dead. I said, what happened? A bottle of vodka, a bottle of vodka last night. He died. We had to actually unplug him at 4 in the morning. Didn't even know I was sponsoring the guy. No, I'm so sorry. No, I'm thinking, I don't know what to say to him. I went home, and I called Marvin right away. I said, Marvin, you sick son of a bitch. You told me to sponsor this guy, and he's dead. Marvin said, well, I'm grateful you got to experience that. I said, you're grateful? You sick son of a bitch. So let me tell you why I'm grateful. But first, let me ask you a few questions. I said, I want you to know that whether he's alive or dead is between him and God. It has nothing to do with you. But I want to know something. Did you tell that man the same truth that I told you? No. He said, why not? He said, it's not really popular to hang around here. People don't like you to talk about that. He said, well, that's why I'm grateful, because I bet you'll never do that again. Next time somebody comes and asks you for the truth, tell them the truth, whether they like it or not. Because you won't want to watch them die right in front of you. Now the choice is yours. And I'm grateful because it's going to make you really passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to change a lot of lives. Never forget that, man. Because of that, man, I have passion about this program. And I'm not afraid to speak the truth. 8 other sponsees have died in the last 7 years. A total of 9, I think, at the funerals. Others have probably died I don't know about. But 9 that have been to the funerals. The men I sponsored. And then a meeting when I had a guy goes, man, why are you sponsoring me? Well, there's been a few others that have been successful. Some of them have grown up and is now scattering seed of their own. There's a little parable about seed scattering you might want to read someday. It's in another big book. I never knew what it meant, and I do now. Because I've seen the seed, the new plants grow, and new seeds scatter. All because a guy loved me enough to tell me the truth, even though it wasn't popular. All because the guy loved me enough to take the time to show me what I couldn't see by myself. Let me see my truth. So tonight, I'm supposed to carry this message. But if you had asked me 4 months in what was AA's message, I would have said, AA's message, easy, don't drink and go to meetings. No, that's the message I carry. Marvin would say, you might want to read that again. I'm going to read it again. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, who knew? We tried to carry this message. I said to him at one point, well, what's this message? He said, you just read it. That you have spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. So that's exactly what happened to me. As a result of that, I'm not perfect today. But I'll tell you this. Whether I've been divorced, or lost jobs, or no matter what's happened in my life, I've never once had a desire to drink. Possibly. One night you might want to read the doctor's opinion. It talks about being able to control desire. I didn't think that was possible. I came to AA and they told me, you're always going to desire a drink. You're an alcoholic. Well, that's not what the doctor said. If I was willing to follow a few simple rules, that's what the word the doctor uses for our steps, rules. So as I live my life by those rules, something happens. My job here tonight has been to carry this message to you. So you can take this flame, let it burn brightly for you, go light someone else with it, and watch what happens. The fellowship will grow up around you. It'll be a wonderful thing to be a part of. You can watch the dead come back to life. Absolutely amazing. So if you've not experienced that, find someone who has and ask them to show you how. It'll change your life. Anyway, that's all I got.